I'm Captain Benjamin Sisko. Welcome to Deep Space Nine.
Red alert! All crew members report to battle stations.
Red alert. Shields up.
What shields?
You Starfleet officers! Now start acting like it!
Oh, it's just Garrick. Plain, simple, Garrick.
Dax, we might have just discovered the first stable wormhole known to exist.
The wormhole does bring them our way, doesn't it?
Everyone wants a piece of the new frontier.
This will shortly become a leading center of commerce and of scientific exploration. But for Starfleet, one of our most important posts.
Quite a motley crew you've assembled here, Benji.
Listen to The Prophets, a Deep Space Nine podcast. And here are your hosts, Andrew Leyland and Paul Spataro.
Bloody hell. Oh, I love a woman in uniform.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Listen to the Prophets, a Deep Space Nine podcast that proves to me that if I want to be clever, I need to write things down, because I actually had a clever title or a clever intro to this episode in mind last night as I watched the episode, and I don't remember what it was. So here I am being not clever with my good buddy, Mr. Andy Leyland.
Hello.
And we are joined once again this week by our friend Blaine Dowler, who has deemed it acceptable to get up at 4 o'clock in the morning and come on the show with us, and we really do appreciate it. Welcome aboard again, Blaine.
Oh, thanks for having me.
It's, you know, we do this so that you work hard so we don't have to. And do we have any non-DS9 Star Trek things to talk about before we jump right into an episode here?
No. Nothing has happened in the 5 minutes since we've hung up and
did another recording. Oh, come on, there has to be something that's happened.
Well, I'm sure more people woke up in the town of Vulcan. That's just a few hours' drive from where I live.
Yay!
They've gone a little nuts on the Star Trek thing. Like,
have they?
The pharmacy has a mural with every doctor painted on the side. They've got the Enterprise of the hometown. They happen to be named Vulcan, and they went nuts with it to the point that when the first J.J. Abrams film came out, they had lobbied to get the Star Trek movies in their theater because it's a tiny little town and it hadn't happened for release for any of them. And then residents went to Leonard Nimoy and presented the situation, and they showed him what pictures of the town and what they'd done. So he lobbied to Paramount, and he managed to get them to an advanced screening he couldn't get it to Vulcan because it's too small, but they managed to get Paramount to pay for buses that would show up at Vulcan, load up anyone in town who wanted to go, and drive them to the closest city that was big enough to have the screening, and they saw it there.
Well, that's cool. I'm a little disappointed that they wouldn't do a special screening for them, even with them being a small town, but I was scared that you were going to say that when the first Abrams movie came out, they decided to blow up the town.
That would have been unfortunate.
They got a little red matter and took care of it. Yeah, so nothing new has gone on. I'm thinking by the time this episode comes out, Star Trek Beyond will already have been out for a while. And maybe we'll do a special episode when that comes out, because I know I'm going to see it. So maybe we'll do a little review episode for that. We'll veer off topic for 1 week, and if we're going to review that movie, it might as well be on this show. And, as long as you're not going to mind spoilers, because you've said, Andy, that you don't plan on watching it unless the reviews are extremely...
Unless you come in and say, no, it's really good, then I probably won't bother.
Okay, well...
I'll watch it when it comes on home video or whatever.
So we may, assuming my review is that positive, then we may have to give it a little while, because if I tell you you need to go see it, then we'll wait until you do before we do a review of it.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, the scheduled release date for that is July 22nd, so...
And we're now in the end of January as we record this, and we have... I think this will make 10 episodes. So, yeah, this may come out before the movie, then.
Yeah, this is probably going to be about a May or June release, then.
Yeah, so...
About 20 weeks out of 26, so...
And we're going to see, you know, depending on how we go as far as recording... We've threatened to go with a weekly release schedule since the show went on, but so far we're still bi-weekly, as of this recording date, at least. Anyway, today's episode, I am very psyched to talk about. So why don't we just jump into that rather than try and come up with some more faux news to discuss.
Oh, yeah. I mean, this is the big one. The season 2 finale. Season 2, episode 26, which makes it episode 45 overall. The Jem'Hadar.
They come from the other side of the galaxy.
The Dominion will no longer stand by and allow ships from your side to violate our territory.
They come with a lethal force.
No one ever escapes from the Jem'Hadar.
They come to conquer.
Commander Sisko will serve as an example of what happens to anyone who interferes with the Dominion.
Now the Federation faces its deadliest enemy.
You have no idea what's begun here.
On the next Star Trek Deep Space Nine.
Directed by Kim Friedman, written by Ira Stephen Baer. Original air date June 12th, 1994. Plot synopsis courtesy of some number of Wikipedia authors is: Commander Sisko and his son Jake get ready for a camping trip to a planet in the Gamma Quadrant. Jake wants his best friend Nog to come along, and Sisko barely agrees when it means he'll have to deal with Nog's Uncle Quark coming as well. Still, they made plans, so Sisko ferries the group to the planet and they set up camp. Quark and Sisko argue, sending an embarrassed Nog off into the woods with Jake chasing after him. Sisko and Quark are startled when an alien woman comes running out of the forest, pursued by a troop of fierce soldiers. Returning to camp to find Sisko and Quark gone, Jake and Nog set out in search of them. Meanwhile, Sisko, Quark, and the woman, Eris, are taken to a cave where they are imprisoned by a force field. Eris is unable to disable the field telekinetically because of a collar placed around her neck. She tells Sisko that the soldiers are Jem'Hadar, bred and put into service by the Dominion, who rule this section of the Gamma Quadrant. Sisko is sure they can outsmart the four guards stationed to watch them, and decides to start by removing Eris's collar. While he works on it, Jake and Nog find the cave where Sisko and Quark are being held, but cannot get past the guards to save them. Third T'Lak T'Lan, leader of the Jem'Hadar group, tells Sisko, Quark, and Eris that the Dominion will no longer tolerate the presence of ships from the other side of the wormhole. Meanwhile, Jake and Nog return to the runabout to try to beam Sisko and Quark aboard. When this fails, Jake realizes he'll have to get help, but can't disengage the ship's autopilot to escape orbit. After several hours, Sisko is finally able to remove part of Eris's collar and enlists Quark to pick the lock. Meanwhile, Jake is finally able to disengage the autopilot. Later, T'Lak T'Lan materializes on DS9 and tells the crew that Sisko is being detained by the Dominion, then transports away before he can be caught. Captain Kyo, in command of the Galaxy-class starship USS Odyssey, arrives at the station to assess the situation and mount a rescue mission. He allows the station's two runabouts, crewed by Major Kira, O'Brien, Dax, Odo, and Dr. Bashir, to accompany the Odyssey on its mission. Quark manages to remove Eris's collar, then she disengages the force field and the three escape. Meanwhile, the Odyssey and the runabouts are attacked while O'Brien beams aboard Sisko, Quark, and Eris. One of the Jem'Hadar ships then flies directly into the Odyssey and destroys it in a kamikaze run. Back at the station, Quark discovers Eris's collar is a fake, and they deduce that she is a spy for the Dominion. But before they can arrest her, she transports away, leaving the crew with the realization that their dealings with this powerful new enemy have only begun.
Now, the fact that you were here to do that, Blaine, saved everybody else from me having to read the synopsis. And you have far more of a radio-type voice than I do, so thank you. I love this episode. I thought this was great. I thought this really was so engaging that it started off a little slow with the whole, you know, we're going on a trip premise. And it picked up steam so quickly. As soon as we started getting unwanted visitors on the trip, it picked up steam and it just never slowed down until the end. I think this is one of the best episodes, but in a different way than some of the other best episodes have been. And I don't want to give up too much of where I'm going with my rating and everything, but some of the other episodes that we've really, really enjoyed have been because they've created such a psychological dilemma, or they've given us insight into how people think, or something like that. This one really doesn't have that. This one is such a good episode because it sets up not only a credible threat, but a threat that you start saying, how can they defeat them? And one of the biggest moments is destroying a galaxy-class starship for us to see, with, you know, somewhat ease. So, you know, what are we as Starfleet? Because that's where we're sitting in their shoes as we're watching this episode. What are we going to do to quell this threat? And I think you walk away from the episode with, you know, with Sisko absolutely set that he's, you know, he's going to prepare to do so. But I think we're at a loss to understand how. They aren't able to keep these people from transporting out. They aren't able to keep them even in a containment area. They aren't able to defeat their small ships when you assume that there are many, many more and larger ones that can come after us. And they have access to the wormhole from their side. Not only that, but apparently through reference, they've killed or subjugated the people that have gone over to start, you know, living on that side of the wormhole. So it's a huge threat that, to me, rivals, equals, or even surpasses the Borg in DS9 and in the movies and in Voyager.
Okay. Guys? Yeah, I would agree with all of that.
Yeah, I really enjoyed this one as well. Go on, Blaine, you go first.
Yeah, it's, I mean, the one thing I would have to add about what we learn about the threat of the Dominion is that not only have they been destroying the colonies on the other side, they've got access to intelligence and are well aware of who the Starfleet personnel on Deep Space Nine are and what that is. So they've got information coming to them already. So yeah. They're, you know, if this breaks out to war and we know at the end that's a definite possibility, the Federation is sort of, you know, they're on the back burner and they're at a disadvantage in every conceivable way from what we can see at this point.
I really like this one as well. I watched Psycho again the day before I watched this, and I was struck by how both of them become different films halfway through. And you start, the first half of this does feel like it's going to be a nice little fuzzy romp as Sisko and Quark go on a holiday together. And then it becomes much more serious and deadly at the midway point. And they do a really good job of transitioning from that comedy opening to the drama of the final bit. They do a really good job of establishing what's going on back at the station. The cut in between the two is really effective. So the story all builds up really well. The captain of the Keo is the guy who rebuilt Steve Austin, or the second,
yes,
Dr. Rudy,
yes,
Wells.
Dr. Rudy Wells.
So
yes.
That's always nice to have a $6 million man connection. And he's also the voice of Skeletor, so that's not worth throwing it. But I like the character dynamics in this one. Are great. Him and Dax just don't like each other. And we're never told why. Which I liked. I like that these two have a past, they don't like each other for whatever reason, and they just get on with it. It's just, all right, we're both in the same team, okay. Quark's brilliant in this episode. Absolutely wonderful. I love all of his moments. I especially love his speech that, you know, you humans look down on us, but we have nothing in our history as bad as concentration camps. We have nothing in our history as bad as the racial persecution that you have. And that's just a brilliant bit, because one of the things that this show has done really well is take the quite laughable Ferengi of the first couple of episodes of Next Generation and make them into, not a threat, because the Ferengi aren't a threat, but make them into a believable three-dimensional race of akin to the Klingons and the Cardassians, although on a different level. And Armin Shimerman, just brilliant in this episode, all the way through it.
I like when he's trying to embarrass Sisko into letting him come on the trip. Would you let your son marry a Ferengi girl? Well, I had never thought about it.
And then he uses that as, exactly. It's like, well, I've never given it any consideration, to be honest with you. And it's all just brilliant. But then the ending, the special effects are actually quite good, with the Odyssey versus the Jem'Hadar, and taking a real beating. And then, like it says at the end, they blow the Odyssey up because they can.
Yeah, there's no reason for it to retreat at the time.
Yeah, Starfleet have got their personnel back. They were leaving, and the guy suicide bombs them just because, well, I'll show you what we can do.
Yeah,
and it's
not
a brilliant
just
ending.
Because they can, it's to send a message.
Yeah, basically.
Yeah, the production crew did it because they can, because, hey, there's a Galaxy-class model we don't need again because we need to build a new one for the movie anyway.
Yeah, well, there is. That's the only little bit that is a bit of let's show how powerful this race is by blowing up an Enterprise-type vessel. It's always like the Justice League cartoon. Let's show how powerful this new bad guy is by having him beat on Superman. So it's the same thing, but it was so well done.
Now, they said in the promotional commercial for this one, they show the Odyssey blowing up and wanted everybody to think that it was the Enterprise. Hmm. And what I read about it, I think it was on Memory Alpha, was the producers had no doubt that had it been Picard and the Enterprise, the result would have been the same.
Yeah, they say that in the companion as well. As far as they're concerned, if this had been Picard, the result would have been the Enterprise would have been destroyed, because that was the point of the Jem'Hadar.
So it wasn't that that Rudy Wells did anything wrong.
Nope, it wasn't that he was an insipid commander or anything like that. That was one thing that Ira Stephen Burr says in the companion. He was really adamant that this not be an inept Starfleet commander, that this be a guy who is every bit as good as Picard, who has a crew every bit as good as Picard's crew, but he's just outclassed.
Yeah.
If anything, I would say that this captain is better suited to this particular mission. He's got a much more military mindset than Picard did.
Picard would have surrendered.
Yeah. I mean, Picard would have been blown out of the sky when he was trying to open negotiations.
Yeah. So, and I liked Keogh, but I mean, the fact that it was Rudy Wells in a wig was nice. But Alan Oppenheimer's a great actor anyway. But the most unusual thing about him in this role was he doesn't have his tash. It took me a minute to recognize who it was. Show's dead.
You just killed the show, Andy.
Sorry.
Yeah, I mean, to me, the biggest thing, again, that I walked away with at the end of this one was it felt like the Borg did to me. Like the Borg when they were truly a real credible threat, before they decided to delve into the Borg and find out what they're really like and what their emotions are like and blah, 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 blah. This was the, we don't really know what's going on with these people, and they have technology that's at a point that we can't match it, and we can't stop them, and they are clearly aggressive and against us. So that to me was the big thing I left off with. And let's keep in mind, while we'll be back with another episode of Listen to the Prophets in 2 weeks, these people had to wait whatever it was, 4 or 5 months for the next episode of DS9, with this being the way it left off. And no question in my mind that if I'm watching this now under those circumstances, I can't wait to see the next episode. I was tempted yesterday, as soon as this one ended, to start season 3 and start watching it, but I didn't, because first of all, I didn't want to cloud my mind with stuff coming up as we record this, and second of all, I didn't want to watch it when I know we're not recording the next episode for several weeks, and I didn't want to have it that, you know, I watched it so long ago that my memories are vague. But I really was tempted to watch it. So I ended up watching Undiscovered Country after this finished, just because I needed to have more of a Star Trek fix.
Right. Yeah. See, the thing, one of the things we've talked about when we've been doing this is some of these are distinctly unmemorable. I remembered every bit of this, and I've only ever watched it once.
Yeah, this is one I also remembered it from that June 12, 1994 broadcast date. This is one of the ones I was there for. And to Paul's point, the next episode was September 26th of that year, so it's about 3.5 months between episodes to figure out what was happening next.
Because it's not a cliffhanger in the sense that the best of the both worlds is a cliffhanger, but there's certainly enough here to make you want to come back next season. And I think they had the added impetus here that when they came back the next season, they were going to be the only Trek show on the Earth. And the Next Generation had gone away. Voyager wasn't starting until January. So they had a good couple of months, though, where Deep Space Nine was the only Trek show.
Now, yeah. You got to wonder, from a logistic point of view, in this type of situation, how intense is Starfleet's preparation for this? Now, you keep in mind, too, that the Borg is still a credible threat that they haven't totally figured out how to deal with. And so you have that, and you have the Dominion now. And how do you prepare, and how do you divide your forces, and what do you do? Because now we really are we're getting away from the Gene Roddenberry model of, you know, everybody loves each other and there's some the occasional threat, but when it's over we all hold hands and sing Kumbaya. We are now a much, much more military organization that's dealing with threats to our way of life. And to some extent, that is emphasized to me about by the whole Ferengi nature in this episode, because while the Ferengi, as you were talking about, are presented as being more of a realistic race and that they have some depth to them and that they're interesting, they are also as far from warlike as anybody on Trek has pretty much been portrayed to be. And you would think at this point that they probably would have been subjugated by one of these aggressive races, whether it be the Klingons, the Cardassians, or the Dominion, or the Borg for that matter. Mm. Because what type of defenses do they have to any of that?
Yeah, they don't seem to be very militaristic, but they will cut a deal.
Yeah, exactly. Well,
right? They will say, you want to take over our planet to have access to the resources? Well, let's just negotiate a price on those resources.
There's a couple of moments with that in this episode where, you know, at least that came to mind for me. Is the first one is when they go to the planet and they start talking about how beautiful it is, and Quark says something to the extent of, you know, unlimited resources to use up or something. I don't remember his exact line, but you know that's how he sees it. You know, everybody else is looking at how beautiful all the trees and everything are, and he's looking at it and thinking, well, we could strip mine this planet.
Yeah, the Memory Alphabet, or Memory Alpha, has the exact quote as, I'll tell you what I see in two words, exploitable resources.
There you go. Which I think is just great. It's so very Ferengi. So I like that aspect of it a lot. But I also like that Quark is the one who figures out that the Vorta is a plant. Mm-hmm. I like that, you know, he's even one step ahead of Sisko on that.
Yeah, and I like the way that was foreshadowed. Like, this is beautiful structure. Everything was set up. When Quark starts working on it, he says, I've never seen a telekinetic suppressor this compact. Usually they're much bulkier. There could be a market for this in the Alpha Quadrant. So they've already basically said, yeah, this thing is too small to the job they're saying it's doing. And it's not until later he goes, yeah, we need to talk.
Yeah. But then you know, you throw into that too. Now they have this information. They know that she's a plant. They haven't revealed it to her yet. And then as soon as they confront her with it, they are unable to keep her. Because that would have been something that would have given you just a kind of a sense of relaxation ending this season and waiting for the next one. All right, they've basically captured this Vorta. They're going to get information from her. They're going to learn about weaknesses to the Dominion. They're going to start to match the Dominion's knowledge of the Federation. But no, no, she just taps her wrist and she's gone. And they have no idea. They not only can't they stop her from doing it, they don't even know where she teleported to. Mm-hmm. So again, it's presenting them as a threat that's way beyond our current scientific ability to combat. And it's just done so well. And I think this is status quo from this point forward. I think for seasons 3 through 6, we're going to see a cliffhanger. If it doesn't match this one, it'll come close to it every year.
Mm. Yeah, the show changes here. And I think this is what we've been building to in watching all of these episodes. It's at this point, I think, that Ira Stephen Burr becomes executive producer, because Piller and Berman go off to develop Voyager. And he basically just remolds the show into something completely different. And I think it's at this point the people that don't like it won't like it. Because from now on, it becomes a very different kind of Star Trek than what we've seen before. But I think I would argue it's still Star Trek. And there are episodes coming up in this series from this point that not only go toe-to-toe with some of the best Next Generation, but I think can go, you know, 12 rounds with stuff from the original show.
I think the thing that separates the best episodes from this show from the best episodes of TNG or the best episodes of the original series is the continuing narrative on this show. This show is less of a... From this point forward, the best episodes of this show are less standalone than those episodes were. This show kind of requires that you know what's going on and you know... Or you know or are willing to see what's to come.
Yeah.
So some of the best episodes for this one, you can't just put on for somebody who is not a fan of the show and say, watch this and it's going to hook you. The only one that jumps out at me off hands is Trials and Tribulations, because that one is more or less standalone and it's considered to be one of the best episodes of this series.
Also, Duet from Season 1.
I'm sorry?
Also, Duet from Season 1, I'd put in that pile.
Oh yeah, no, I'm talking from this point forward though.
Oh yeah.
The episodes that stand out in my mind as some of the best episodes of this series, if you didn't know the characters, if you don't know the ongoing storyline as far as the Dominion War and what's happening, I don't think that they have as much gravitas as if you do.
Yeah, you can get someone into the original series or Next Gen by saying, hey, sit down and watch this episode or these handpicked two or three episodes. You want to get someone into Deep Space Nine, it's not, here, sit down and watch this episode, it's here, sit down and watch this season.
Yeah, I think that's what we're looking at, and I think if you have somebody who either didn't have the patience to watch an entire season or was so tied into the concept as presented in the original series that they didn't want to expand on them, that's where this show will lose you. So, for me, it pulled me in further, but for some people, I think it pushed them away.
Yeah. No, it did the same with me as well. From this point on, I think it becomes one of the stronger of the Trek shows. In fact, I there are times when I vacillate, but I actually think overall, from Series 3 onward, this is a better show than The Next Generation.
Oh, I think so. Yeah. To me, you know, the original series will always have its special place, and it's going to have some weaknesses in that the special effects of the time and the budget of the time didn't allow them to do certain things, and just the nature of series television at that time was not to have an ongoing narrative, so you didn't necessarily build on concepts the way you might have liked. Other than those inherent weaknesses, the original series is always going to be the most special Star Trek, and it's going to be the groundbreaker, and it's going to be the one that I love the most. But if you take all of the spin-offs from it, DS9 is my favorite. There's no question.
Yeah, I would say personally, if you can take out the impact it had on genres and on TV and remove all of the outside elements and just look at each series purely as a piece of entertainment, I would put Deep Space Nine at the top of the list.
Yeah.
Well, the only place, and I don't, you know, it's hard to separate quality from nostalgia sometimes. But the only place where I would have to argue that point is, you know, William Shatner, Leonard Nimoy, DeForest Kelly, James Doohan. I don't know if that particular cast has ever been matched, even by this one. And I love the cast of this one. I'm not trying to put it down in any way, shape, or form. But, and again, it's hard for me to separate nostalgia from reality sometimes. But, you know, like I said, the original series will always be my favorite.
Yeah, we've not mentioned Jake and Nog, who are really good in this episode.
Especially when they get control of the runabout.
Yeah.
And Nog gets in there, he starts trying to shoot photon torpedoes.
Because Star Trek has a reputation of not being able to do children. And yet here's Jake putting light to that. He's never irritating. He's never over the top. He's been a really good supporting character throughout the entire show. And here he's got a scene-stealing moment with Nog. It's brilliant stuff.
Even when he invites Nog along for the ride, it's very realistic. The kids in your house, Blaine, may be too young for you to have dealt with this yet. But there are instances where you start thinking, oh, I'm going to do this with my kids, and the next thing you know, they're with a friend, and all you are is sitting in the background watching them and their friends instead of actually interacting with them like you had planned on doing. And it is an eye-opening moment where you have to say to yourself, well, you know what? In the grand scheme of things, I'm not supposed to be their best friend.
Yeah, and it is so well set up, again, with Jake and Nog. Like, I talked about the foreshadowing and the setup. I'm a sucker for a well-structured story, and that's exactly what this is. I mean, from the first conversation when Sisko, this whole camping trip set up because Jake had to do a science project and Sisko wanted him to do something more ambitious than watching roots grow. What's Jake's next suggestion? Learn how to fly a runabout. So we know this is something he's already interested in, and it establishes that interest and that he may know something about it by the time he gets to the point where he has to. Right. We've already seen that he was helping Nog learn to read, and then it gets to the point where he's saying, no, Mrs. O'Brien said that Nog has to be part of the entire process. If he doesn't do this, he's going to drop out of school. I can't let that happen. Please let him come. Right. It says so much about Jake and that relationship he has with Nog.
From a structure point of view that you're pointing to, and when you start breaking down these shows, sometimes when you start looking at structure or just the individual moments, that's when they start to fall apart. You know, I think that's the two areas where they fall apart is either structure, where you start having people doing things out of character to move the plot along, or you have convenient plot elements that happen. And the other part is the science. And thankfully, we really didn't have one where we need you to analyze the science too much for us. Because I think that that's where the other place where they fail. But just going into the structure on this one, I think everything that occurs on this episode has a purpose, but it never feels like exposition, and it never feels like convenient plot devices. So when they sat down in whatever writing room they had and they put together this episode, they did a masterful job. This is one of the best written episodes without a lot of those, you know, in-depth character moments. The closest thing to character moments, I think, are Quark, and, you know, that's more comic relief in its own way. So they just showed us again how they can put together a great episode in a different way than they've put together other great episodes.
Absolutely. Even like you said, the lack of convenient plot device, normally you need a really good explanation for why Quark is the one coming with Nog instead of Rom. Right? By all logic up to this point, Quark should be the one riding the bar, and if anyone goes with Nog to watch, it's Rom. But here, no, Quark has his own ulterior motives. He wants to get permission to advertise on the station view screen, so he wants to get close to Sisko to do that negotiation and make that happen. Yeah. So it does not feel forced at all to have Quark on this mission. We know what his goals are, and we know that he's shooting for that advertising before he finds out about the trip.
Character moment, I'm sorry if I interrupted you that way. The other character moment we touch on is Odo actually admitting to a fondness for Quark.
Yeah.
Which is totally unexpected, but something we've all known exists as the show has been going on. And now it's him actually saying it, which is, you know, a little surprising but then Odo is kind of a no-nonsense guy, so what you see is what you get with Odo, and he comes right on and says, yeah, you know, of course we want to get him back.
Yeah, admit it, you'd miss him too.
Yeah. You know, he enjoys that chess game that they're constantly playing and admits it. And that's one of the things about this show that just, you know, it's people have real emotions on the show.
Oh, yeah. Even Morn.
And we had a great Morn moment. That's true. We did not have Morn on the last episode, which was disappointing always. But we have had just as Morn is about to explain his troubles. That was, you know, for such an intense episode, there's some quality comedy in this one, and pretty much all provided by Quark and a little bit by Rom. Not Rom,
Nog.
Nog.
Yeah, and I wonder how much of this led into where they would take Nog in future seasons. Hmm.
Yeah, well, Nog ends up, you know, not to spoil too much ahead, but Nog ends up being a very three-dimensional character as it goes on.
Yeah. Which I can say about has an arc.
Sorry?
Yeah, he very much has an arc here.
Yes. Yeah, yeah. But that's one of the beauties of the show, and I mean, I feel like I'm starting to beat a dead horse, but almost everybody has an arc. There's really nobody who is the same at the end as they were in the beginning.
Which is a stark contrast to most other Trek shows. I mean, you look at, say, Next Generation. A little bit of growing pains in season one. But you pick any character at the start of season two and drop them as they are in a season seven episode, and I don't expect them to make all the same decisions for all the same reasons. Mm. There's very little change in the thought process. I would not say that's true of Deep Space Nine.
In thinking about TNG, the only thing I can think of that they tried to be a little bold with and they quickly realized what a fail it was and dropped it was the idea of having Worf and Troy have a romantic relationship. And that got dropped so quick. It was like a hot potato.
Yeah. Yeah, it lasted long enough to sort of have the characters wrap up the series, and then they got to the movies and the ongoing stories. It's like, yeah, apparently the fans want Troy and Riker together.
What's so, yeah. Married.
No, yeah, I think a lot of that.
Not been saying that for 7 years.
Yeah, I also think part of the reason they dropped it was because that made it easier to bring Worf to Deep Space Nine without Troy.
Mm. Yeah, oh, that's true too.
But and they get involved with Jadzia. So.
See, I'm into stunt casting. I would have brought on Jeannie Francis to be the romantic interest for Riker, since she's his wife in real life.
They did that in Lois and Clark.
I never watched Lois and Clark. What did they do?
Jonathan Frakes and Jeannie Francis played husband and wife bad guys.
Oh, yeah, okay.
Yeah, but Lois and Clark liked their stunt casting. They also had the people who played the Jeffersons in, you know, totally different characters in one of their Christmas episodes.
Hmm. Yeah, that was a show I just never... I had kind of turned off to the superhero TV genre. You know, I never watched the Superboy show before that. I never watched Lois and Clark. And then someone finally convinced me to watch Smallville, and then that pulled me back in for, I guess, probably about 7 of the seasons before it... You know, we talked about shows overstaying their welcome earlier, and I think for at least for me, Smallville did.
Yeah, Smallville could have lost a couple of the middle seasons easily.
Yeah. Well, basically, after they killed off Pa Kent, it kind of lost its steam for me.
Yeah, I think they changed showrunners after season 7, and I think it picks up again at that point. But the original showrunners are doing something of a holding pattern for their last couple of years.
Smallville didn't have enough episodes with Tom Wopat in them.
Well, was he in 2?
I think so. I know he was in a couple.
Yeah, I specifically remember the first one he was in, but I don't remember after that for sure.
Yep, and apparently Clark doesn't meet anyone for the first time as an adult. He met everybody in his life as a teenager.
Well, it's also the inherent problem on Gotham.
I don't watch Gotham for the same reasons.
Gotham, I've stuck with it at times where I thought I was going to drop it off, and I guess this is the conversation we should have had before we talked about the episode, but whatever.
You can still make it an outtake.
Flow right along. Everybody stay with us. But as Gotham got towards the end of season 1, it became much more interesting to me. And so far, season 2 has been pretty decent. My biggest complaint is exactly that, though. They would have been better off just not having Bruce Wayne in it at all. They would have been better off having either new villains or villains that clearly were in existence. Like, I'm okay with Penguin coming to power while Bruce Wayne is a young boy. I'm not quite as good with the Riddler developing his persona at this point. But
I admit I have yet to watch an episode of Gotham. Part of the issue I have, because I've heard so much about how, you know, Bruce Wayne is in like the 10 to 12 year old range and all of his future villains are young adults. That means we're going to have, when Batman finally comes out, we're going to have a guy in his physical prime that's, you know, trained to fight, beating on a number of people who are anywhere from 10 to 20 years older than he is.
Yeah, no, that's an aspect of it. Now, I can accept that with the fact that I'm putting Penguin at probably 10 years older than him. Penguin, to me, is never supposed to be a physical threat to Batman anyway. Penguin, when played the best, he's almost, you know, a psychological, you know, putting wheels in motion, almost like the Kingpin.
Okay, so when you say played the best, you mean not by Danny DeVito?
I'm not even talking about live action. when the character is used the best is probably the better way to phrase that.
I think Gotham could have been much improved if they'd just done Gotham Central. Yeah. And Batman's just an off-camera presence, or you glimpse him briefly every now and again, and just do Gotham Central as a TV show. I think that would have worked brilliantly.
So you have Batman on Gotham, similar to the way you have Superman on Supergirl.
Yeah.
You watched Supergirl, right?
Oh, yes.
Okay, so the way, you know, we know he exists, he's out there, he sometimes makes contact either by text, or there was the one episode where we saw him, you know, in a hazy shot where you couldn't really make out any details. So you know he's around, and he even has some sort of influence over what's going on, but he's never, ever, ever the focus of an episode.
Yeah, you have Commissioner Gordon shutting the bat signal off as somebody walks out onto the roof, and you may see him swinging off. And that's it. Because that's what Gotham Central was. The comic book was that. Batman was, as far as I remember, not in it very much at all. And I think when they announced Gotham, they were saying we're doing Gotham Central. And I think if they had done Gotham Central, I may have been more interested in it.
Well, I think the choices they've made have been more to pull in the casual fan who are going to say, oh, I know who the Penguin is, and I know who the Riddler is. You know, but there are choices that they've made from a comic fan perspective that I don't agree with. You know, Selina Kyle actually witnessed the murder of the Waynes, and now she's developed a relationship with Bruce already. And then, you know, like, that takes it a little too far as having the connection.
Yeah, so if they ever develop the romance, it's going to be kind of creepy, because that's like... I don't know. They may be the age of consulting adults when it starts, but... I mean... I used to babysit kids who are the age of consenting adults now. There's still no chance anything's going to happen there, because I still see them, you know, as the 4 and 5 year old kid that they were.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, too much of an age gap. It's just
she's well, they don't have a huge age gap. I'm saying he's about at least as the actor is probably older, but as portrayed on the show, he's probably supposed to be about 12, and she's probably supposed to be about 14.
Okay,
let that vary within about 2 years and in either direction. But I think if you move her up by 2 years, move him up by 2 years as well. I think there's about a 2 year age difference between the two, so it's not so much of a cougar relationship that it would be disturbing.
So it's Anakin and Padme.
No, exactly.
The episodes of Gotham I saw, Catwoman was only about 12 or 13 or something. And he's supposed to be 9 or 10, yeah.
Okay, yeah, so you haven't seen any. I just heard everyone else is like 10 years older, so that would be much better.
And like I said, I'm okay with that with the Penguin, because I see him more as, you know, the way they're actually showing him is he's kind of like somewhat crazy mob boss. And this is his rise to power in that role, and I'm okay with him already being in that power by the time Batman comes around.
Yeah, for the Penguin, that definitely works. For, you know, other characters that are supposed to be more of a physical threat, I don't know if the age gap would work, but maybe I should just stop commenting on a show I've never watched.
No, actually, I think your commentary is very telling, because it shows what somebody watching the show or what the average comic fan is going to think and what's going to influence whether or not they watch the show. And the reasons that you've articulated for staying away from it make total sense to me. And it's as I said, there have been several times where I thought, okay, I'm going to give up on this one. And I haven't. But it's not because of any reason that I can set forth that actually makes sense. If that makes sense. It's just, you know, I basically, it's one of these things, it's similar to Smallville in many respects, that you have to turn off your knowledge of the comic book universe and just kind of take it as it's coming and saying this is a different world.
Yeah, well, it was practically the original pitch for Smallville. But I don't know if you heard the controversy when Smallville hit the air, but somebody had gone to the WB and pitched the idea for a show of Bruce Wayne becoming Batman, starting with the death of the Waynes. And the WB turned that down because they're about to do movies with Batman, and then they went to Miller and Gough and pitched them the idea for doing the same concept but with Superman instead. Because they didn't have the same level of movie plans for Superman. And then, yeah, if you listen to the commentary track on the first episode of Smallville, Miller and Gough make comments that make it clear that when the Warner Brothers came to them and pitched the show, they had no knowledge of any prior pitches. It was an idea brought to them. So to me, having read the online controversy, it seemed to be their way of saying, yeah, we know somebody pitched that to them. We were unaware of it when we agreed to make this series without actually telling that story.
Mm.
And then I think when Smallville went off the air, it's like, okay, well, now I've got Superman movies active and no Batman movies. So let's try that.
It's not a bad show, I'll put it at that. It's not one that the second it shows up in my DVR, I'm concerned if I wait a little while to watch it.
So is it at least closer to the comics than Fred and Barney Meet the Thing?
It might be similar in its own, as far as that connection goes. But I have yet to hear the Penguin ask his ring thing to do its thing.
Asking his ring to do anything.
You know, if you're going to rhyme and you need to come up with a rhyme for thing, shouldn't you come up with something other than thing? Ring thing, do your thing?
You'd think that would be the first thing they would come up with, but sadly no.
Anyway, just to, you know, we've tangented enough. Let's go back to the Jem'Hadar. Any more commentary on what occurred in this episode? And it's either this episode on its own or its relation to the greater universe.
I don't really want to talk too much about its relation to the greater universe, because that would be spoiling it for listeners who are watching DS9 for the first time along with this podcast. I will say every single element in this episode will come back. in one capacity or another, the Vorta, which is Eris's race, will be back. The Jem'Hadar will be back. The Dominion, which right now are up to this point, they've been potential Ferengi trading partners. And that's how they were known as the Power in the Universe. The Ferengi were trying to open negotiations with them. The Dominion most certainly will be back. And we will find out whether or not the Founders really are just a myth.
Yes. I would comment on a couple of things. First of all, the Jem'Hadar in general, they are very, very much a mystery at this point. Still, you know, you've seen them. You don't know what strengths and weaknesses they have. Clearly, they're intelligent. That's one thing I think you pick up, especially when you wonder about the strategic thought of let's let the people know how much we know about them already, or at least give them a hint of how much we know about them. Is that a smart thing to do, or is it better to keep that in your back pocket and save it in case they do come up with something against you? On the other
even
hand,
the way
they were
he
also
did it.
I'm sorry?
So even the way he did it, the first time we found out how much they learned about the Alpha Quadrant is when the Jem'Hadar was saying, you know, I was really hoping the first alien I'd meet from the Alpha Quadrant would be a Klingon.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think that may have been enough. Like, they may not, they started going into, you know, what they know about Sisko and things like that, that they may not have had to do that to develop the level of concern that they did. But just the same, it was, you know, it was a way of setting them up as an extreme threat. So I really liked that. But there's also starting to sow the seeds to hope for some sort of a little bit of a civil discord there with the so you just do whatever the Dominion tells you to do. You're just you don't have minds of your own, basically. So, and that's something we're going to see come back a little bit. The Vorta. Now, just I thought the Vorta looked familiar. What's her name? Like Ellen or something like that?
Eris.
And I looked up her IMDb page, and the thing that was easiest for me to remember her being in, and there were several things, but the one that jumped out at me most was on Seinfeld. She was the Greek Orthodox nun who couldn't help but fall in love with Kramer because he has the Kavorta. So she was recognizable, and then obviously we had Rudy Wells in there, which was enjoyable as well. You wonder at this point, you know, you don't know who the Founders are. I don't remember how they reveal who they are, and I guess we'll see that either next season or the season after at some point. But that's a little interesting plot thread that comes up and you know, doesn't really seem like anything too significant at this point, but will become extremely significant as we go on.
Yeah, you got about two episodes to wait on that. But...
Oh, yeah, okay, you jumped ahead of on us, that's right. I forgot, you're through season three already, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So, that'll
You could cut that bit out so it doesn't give spoilers to the listeners.
I think that's a mild enough spoiler that we could leave it in. Plus, I think most of the people who listen have seen the series. I don't think there are a lot of people who haven't seen anything or watching along at an episode-by-episode clip.
Well, there you go. So, listeners, if you're watching for the first time, write in and tell us.
Yes. Yes, good point. Because
listen
I don't
to the prophets at gmail.com.
We need to bring him again.
Any more thoughts on this, Andy?
No, I think you've both just covered everything that I was going to bring up. It's a very good episode.
Yeah, so I guess it's time. We've reached the time in the episode where we're going to give our ratings of this one. And my question... Well, actually, wait a minute. Blaine presented this summary on this. You go first.
Okay, well, this... If we're saying that on the 1 to 5 scale, 3 is average for the series, if I were to rate this episode... based solely on the episodes we've seen so far, I'd say this and Duet would be the two that are tied for 5 out of 5. Knowing what's coming, I'm only going to give it a 4. Because the bar is going to be moved much higher over the next 5 seasons.
Okay, that's fair, and yet I'm going to go slightly different on my thought process. I don't question anything of what you're saying there. I think to some extent sometimes I get a little too chintzy on the higher ratings because I know how much I like this show, and I start to say to myself, well, I can't give this a really, really high rating because there are other really good episodes as well. And I think that may be a little wrong-headed for me. So while this may not be the best episode ever, and that'll keep me from giving it a 5, I would put this one, if I was setting up a list and saying, you know, somebody who only had time to watch a couple of episodes every season, you know, maybe 3 or 4 episodes of each season, this would be on the list. You need to watch this one before you go on to the next season. And not just because of the story that's developed, but because of the way it's done and the quality of the episode. So therefore, I'm going to give this, I'm going to say it's not the best ever. This season, the only 5 I've given out was to Blood Oath. So I'm going to say it's not quite at the Blood Oath level, but I'm going to put it up there with Cardassians and Crossover, and I'm going to give it a 4.5.
I am also going to go for 4.5 because Duet is still a high watermark. But this was just as good in its own way. But again, I think I agree with what Blaine is saying in that it's how it informs the rest of the series as well is what makes it so good. So I'm going to go for 4.5 as well.
All right, so that ends season 2 of Deep Space Nine. Now, I think I'm the only one who has... Well, Blaine, you've only rated 2 episodes.
Yeah.
And I'm the and Andy, I don't think you have the list of what you've given to different episodes, because the thought was at the end of each season, you could look back and see if there was an episode that you would change your rating on.
Yep.
So since you don't have in front of me, I guess I'm alone on this. And the one that I would change, based on comparing what I thought of it after I watched it as compared to what I thought about it after I spoke to you and Sean, and having seen the rest of the season and where everything falls into place, I gave a 4 to Sanctuary, and I'm going to lower that to a 3.5.
Right.
But that's the only one. That's the only one that I'm changing at this point. Otherwise, I think we had an uneven season. There was a low point in the middle there where we were just getting what we considered to be either boring or uneventful episodes. And I think we burst out of that with the last, whatever, 4 or 5 episodes of the season with some real quality and a view of where this show is going to go, to the point where I'm very excited about getting into season 3 in 2 weeks.
Yep. So am I. I think, I don't think this was as strong a season as the first. The first had some real lows. But even the lows in the first season were entertaining. It's like watching a baby stumble as it's learning to walk. It's still learning to walk, so it's still fun to watch. The second season, it's like we went through the middle of this season and every single episode was just, it was all right. It wasn't great. And after a while, I was starting to think, It isn't just my memory that this show gets better, right? It does actually get better. But we picked up towards the end with the Marquee. And even though we dissed on some of the acting in that episode, what it was setting up was interesting. And then the last part of the season has just been really good. So it's nice to see that it picked up at the end after a slump in the middle.
And you know, that just reminded me, you know, I talked earlier about how there's all these different threats that they have to consider. And I left the Marquee off that. That's something that's been developed in this season that is a major concern to the Federation. That basically, you know, it's mutineers in the Federation. And that's a big, you know, that's a big factor. Now, it doesn't play out over the course of the series the way they might have originally thought, but it's certainly something that they have to keep in mind and worry about as it's going on.
Yeah.
Yeah, to me, it almost felt like the Maquis on DS9 took a bit of a back burner as soon as Voyager launched, as though they were sort of leaving it for Voyager to deal with, because half the crew is Maquis.
Yeah, and then they found that the discord among the crew didn't work out as well as they liked, so they kind of resolved all those differences very quickly and just became, you know, one coherent crew.
Yeah.
A cohesive crew is probably a better way to say it.
Yeah, that's... Well, this isn't a Voyager podcast, but...
Thankfully.
Yep. Otherwise, I wouldn't be here.
What are we doing in 2 weeks, Andy?
In 2 weeks, it's the beginning of season 3. It's a 2-part episode entitled The Search. Oh, and I didn't do next time. So
I was wondering where that was.
So there you go. I just added it at the end for everyone that misses it. So that's next time.
All right. We'll see you all in 2 weeks.
Bye-bye.
Thanks for coming on, Blaine. Wait a minute. Wait, whoa. Put the brakes on. Blaine, you want to pimp your podcasts?
Yeah, I do a few of them through Bureau42.com. So the unofficial 75 Greatest Marvels Countdown is the weekly show. In Marvel's 75th anniversary, they put out a reader poll about what the greatest 75 stories were, and we're counting those down one at a time. That'll wrap up on June 1st. I also do a monthly comic book physics show. For the next couple of months, Alex Case is stepping in to do the monthly Silver Screen Superhero show. And then we've got a bi-weekly X-Files show, which is, at the time of this recording, just about to start looking at the new episodes in that 6-part miniseries before we go back to where we left off about halfway through season 3.
Okay, well, the comic book physics and the 75 Greatest Marvels I am a devoted listener to. Silver Screen Superheroes I have not listened to yet, but I think I need to. Unfortunately, X-Files is a show I've never signed on for, and from everything I hear about the frustration of people having with not getting answers on it, I'm not sure I ever will, so I'm not going to join you for that. But we also talked about you maybe doing a Buffy show, and if you do, what I'm telling you now, I'm signing on now. I've had several false starts at watching Buffy, but if you end up doing a show, what I'm going to do is I'm going to watch the series as you come out with episodes. I'm going to watch along the way you have suggested that some people might be doing it with DS9 on this show.
Okay. It's good to know. I'll share that with Amanda, because if the Buffy show flies, it'll be Amanda and I doing it to tie in with the 20th anniversary.
Oh, don't say things like that. It makes me feel old.
Oh, shut up. You two young whippersnappers.
Hey, my X-Files show premiered on the 20th anniversary of that pilot, and we're now in season 3 on a bi-weekly show.
And there's a new series of that starting tonight.
There is. Yeah. So I, for one, am looking forward to it, but it's...
So am I.
Yeah, X-Files left a couple questions unanswered. There are more answers than a lot of people recall, because there were major cast changes in the last 2 seasons, so a lot of people stopped watching before the answers actually came. But the answers were there.
You're trying to win me over here. Well, you never know. All of a sudden, I find myself with a lapse in my viewing queue. I'll join you at some point. But
yeah, if you pay attention to the history of production of television, X-Files is huge. It quite literally changed the way TV was made with hour-long dramas. Jerry Bruckheimer says without X-Files, he never would have considered doing TV, and without that, we don't have CSI and all those franchises, for better or worse.
There you go. Shows that I don't watch, but that's okay. There's just so much. I've said on several occasions, I think we really are in the golden age for television drama right now. Shows like Breaking Bad and Game of Thrones and so many other things. And I think a lot of these shows that we're talking about are what led us to this.
Yeah.
So I do agree with you on that perspective. But, you know, there's so many things in my queue and we'll see. We'll see what I can get in there, because I have the one show that I keep saying I have to start watching. That I have access to it, and I just have yet to sit down and do. But I hear so many great things about is The Wire.
Yeah, that's also on my to-do list.
You watched that, didn't you, Andy?
I've never seen The Wire.
Oh, because you've commented on Idris Elba a few times. I thought you had.
I know Idris Elba's in it. I don't think I've ever watched Idris Elba in it.
Okay, well, who knows if it's as good as people say? Maybe after we finish DS9 and that plethora of other shows we've talked about. Anyway,
well, it does sound like you need to do a $6 Million Man podcast.
Oh, totally. Well, Cyborgs has already got that covered.
You know what? I think we could do on $6 Million Man, because I don't think I'd be up to do a beginning to end podcast on it. But if you pick key episodes and we do an occasional $6 Million Man special.
Oh, yeah. $7 Million Man.
$7 Million Man, Bigfoot.
Bionic Woman.
Bionic Woman.
Anytime you fought a robot. Yeah, death probe.
I think we can do an occasional $6 million man guest show, or, you know, special show.
That'd be fun.
You know what? If you're writing in, let us know if you'd be interested.
Yes, Scott.
Because I guarantee you, we will not have started that project before this episode airs.
No. That's a few years down the line.
But anyway, we'll see you all in 2 weeks. Thanks for tuning in, and thanks for coming on with us, Blaine. I really appreciate it.
Thanks, anytime. Blaine. That was good, that.
Yeah, I enjoyed it.
Bye, everybody.
So long.
Goodbye.
Visit our website at twotruefreaks.com. Two True Freaks is always spelled TWOTRUEFREAKS.
You can email Two True Freaks directly at twotruefreaks@gmail.com.
Two True Freaks and all of its excellent affiliates are available on iTunes, and you can choose to subscribe to either the entire network if you wish, or pick whichever individual shows you want to follow. We have so many shows to choose from, there's just bound to be one that appeals to your particular fandom. Just search Two True Freaks with an exclamation mark at the end, space, and the number 2.
You can find Two True Freaks on Facebook. Just search for Two True Freaks. If you ever leave your house and you actually have friends, why don't you tell them about Two True Freaks?
If you've enjoyed our show, please, won't you take a moment to rate us on iTunes? That helps others find the show, too.
Thanks for listening.
And join us every Monday for new episodes of
Two True Freaks.